This is an interview with Bruno Piovesan by Madeleine Regan on the 4th of October 2008 in his home at Kidman Park. Also present is his wife, Graziella. Bruno, we're going to begin this interview by talking about your background. So would you be able to tell me a little about your parents and where they were born and how they came to Australia?
Well, my parents were born in a place called Ponzano Veneto. That's about 25 kilometres from Venice, very close to Treviso. And my father came to Australia at the age of... he was born in 1905, 3rd of December 1905. Said that wrong again, didn't I?
Your mama was born.
No. 4th of December 1905. He came to Australia in 1927. After 7 years of working in Australia, my mother, which he knew as a fiancée in Italy, could not afford a fare to Australia, so she virtually had to find her own money to come to Australia. She came to Australia in 1934, and she was born on the 4th of the 7th, of the 12th, 1907. 4th, 12th, 1907, that's right. They were both born on the same day of the month, actually, but 2 years difference. And like I said, my father came here in 1927, after 7 years, my mother came here. And... Well, I was born in 1937, and the 3rd of December 1937, which is pretty close dates, not easy to forget. And, well...
You had also other siblings?
Yes, two older brothers. One was born in 35, and one was born in 36. So the three of us were born within 3 years of my mother arriving in Australia. And they worked in the market garden, but my father at the time was working in the central of Australia at a place called, would have been above around Tennant Creek in Northern Territory, mining mica. And a couple of the mines had names. One was called the Last Chance Mine, and one was called the Spotted Tiger Mine. There were several others, but I can't virtually remember because I was very young at the time.
Bruno, do you know why your father decided to come to Australia?
I think, like many other people that immigrated from Italy in those years, it was a question of not much future in Italy. And, you know, it was very, very tough living conditions, and they thought sought a better life, so they decided to immigrate. I mean, people went to America, people come to Australia. Uncle of mine went to, Venezuela. And before that, they went to the Congo in Africa, which wasn't very successful. They had to run away from there. And then they went to Venezuela. And, of course, what made my father come to Australia, I don't really know, but I think it was a good choice in the end.
Did he come with any other family?
No, he was by himself. He had to have a discharge from the army to be able to leave the country at the time. And I've still got that certificate with me. This discharge from the army, and he just came to Australia and started working very, very hard, you'd have to say.
But, and a young man, 22.
Yep, very young man, 22, and things were pretty tough. I remember him saying they used to build roads at a place called Karunda, that would be in the Mallee area, and they used to load metal, which are stones virtually, with a manure fork. There were no front end loaders or anything like that.
Amazing.
You know, it was tough.
And So when your father arrived, he went straight to...
He virtually went into the mine straight away up north.
Right.
He went up north, and they used to have provisions sent to them about once every 3 months, and they'd come down to Alice Springs probably once every 6 months and that. And it was very hard work. And they used to mine this stuff called mica, which was used in the resistance for power, for electricity. You know, I can probably toasters and stuff like that these days, you know, and of course plastic's taken that over. And barely wore shoes because I reckon I heard them say that they used to play jokes on each other for something to do. and they'd put a hot coal ash under his feet and they wouldn't even feel it. So things were pretty hard.
And do you know how your father came to be in this area, in the west of Adelaide as a market gardener?
No, I really don't know the reason why they... Maybe Albert might have known that. Albert and Mary might have known. Did they know why their parents came here? No, I think it was just a question of where you're going to stop, you know. Mm. And they virtually, you know, I mean, it was probably there was a demand for people to come to Adelaide and they came to Adelaide. You know, that's about the strength that I know of it, you know.
Yeah. So you were born in 1937.
Yes, 3rd of December 1937.
And can you tell me a little bit about what your life was like as a child?
I was very, very lucky, I suppose. But, I mean, from when I can remember, we always used to have to work because my father, after that, he had glass houses in this area.
Do you know how many he had?
I think about 12. And they used to have a good living out of 12 glass houses. They used to make a good living just with 12 glass houses. I had about 5 acres of land in those years, and used to plant potatoes and other type of beans and things. I remember sowing beans and all this business. And I mean, you had to dig potatoes virtually with a fork to start with, and then they had a plough with all horse-drawn. There was no machinery, just all horse-drawn. And very vividly remember digging glass houses by hand fork. He had to dig a glass house with a hand fork till the age of about 16 or 18. That was before going to work as an apprentice. And it was pretty hard. And virtually, I can remember not coming home from school, didn't even know what homework was, because we'd had our chores to do, take the leaves out of the glass house when they were pruning tomatoes, hoe around the side of the glasshouse so, you know, insects wouldn't get inside of the glasshouse, and always something to do, sowing beans, kept busy all the time. It wasn't a question of not being, having nothing to do, that's for sure. But
and there were three of you, so
yeah,
you were
and I was the youngest, I was always the one getting kicked around, I suppose, but that was always getting ordered around, but it didn't hurt me, I didn't mind, you know.
Did your mum work in the market gardens as well?
Well, the first day after she arrived, they were married by proxy. And my mother used to say all the time she was a second lady in South Australia to be married by proxy. That's rather strange, I suppose, but anyway, in those years, that's how it was. Like, my father was here, my mother was in Italy, and they did, don't ask me how they do it, but that's how they used to do it. It was called, they married by proxy in those years, and then my mother stayed there for several months before she boarded a ship to come to Australia.
But they'd known each other for a long time.
Yeah, they'd known each other from when they were 16 years of age, virtually before that. And but my mum used to say that things were that tough in Italy that once they got married, she virtually was a part of my father's family. But she was told she had to go home because they could not give her enough food to keep her there. Things were a bit hard. You know.
Did she come from an area close by your farm?
They were same village. Same place, Punzano Venice. They might have been about 3 kilometres distance, 2 kilometres distance, something like that. The original homes are still there. My mother's home is still there. My father's been remodeled, been renovated type of thing. But no, everything is still basically the same. And I've been back several times. It's very, very interesting. Several cousins there and... I remember seeing a few of my uncles that have since passed away, and they were very nice. They treat you very well when you go there, and oh, unbelievable. I can barely speak the Venetian dialect, which I couldn't the first time I went over there, but I learnt very quickly, and I still speak it now. That's the only thing my mother used to speak, because virtually schooling was limited in those years. She hardly spoke much English at all after all of her years in Australia. And, of course, when Dad died, he died at the age of 43. He had a cerebral hemorrhage. They said it was the result of some knocks over the years. Don't know where or when, but, I mean, these days they can be saved, but in those days they couldn't. I vividly remember him coming home from the garden, and he was very sick. He went to bed, and I think he lasted about a week after that. That was it.
And you were quite young, Bruno.
11 years old.
Wow.
11 years old. Yeah. But
Very hard for your family then.
I reckon it would have been, you know. I mean, you didn't think much in those years. It would have been pretty hard on your mother. Mm. But It would have been tough with 11, 12 and 13 year olds on her own, and that was it. No real help from the government in those years. You had to work all the time.
And did your mum keep the glass houses?
Oh, yes, with the help of this uncle of mine, which is my father's brother, who was up in the Northern Territory. He came down to Adelaide when my father had passed away. And he virtually went into partnership with my mother with glass houses, and they worked virtually together on the land. In those years, apparently you could do a pretty good living out of with glass houses, because there weren't fumigations in those years. And I mean, every year you had one chore in the summertime was shifting glass houses. So I used to hate it all the time. You used to get two crops a year out of a glass house, and after that they'd get disease. You couldn't grow any more plants in there, they'd all wilt away and die before the crop ripened. So you had to shift glass houses. And that was
a chore.
Oh, big job.
Do you remember what it involved?
Oh, of course. You had to drill a lot of holes with a post hole digger. And it was in the summertime, of course, and it was the glass was hot, the rafters were hot, and I started an apprenticeship. I worked at a place called Gordon Tregoning. When I was 15, I started there. And we used to get 2 weeks holiday a year. And we'd come home and shift glass houses. That was it.
Hard work for a young boy. And
yeah, but I never bothered. That was it.
Gordon Tregoning's in Ashley Street.
What's that?
Gordon Tregoning in Ashley Street?
That's the one, yeah. Gordon Tregoning in Ashley Street. Yeah, I'd worked there for 11 and a half years. I started an apprenticeship at the age of 16, worked there for a year before. And when I started working, I was getting £1.96 a week. That's not a lot of money, even in those years. But,
So the shifting of the glass houses was...
Oh, yes, the shifting of the glass houses, that was hard work, and you had to carry these glass that were pretty heavy for men at a young age and that, and you had to keep shifting them, and they had to set them up, and you had to... This was something that had to be done every Christmas, because there's always some glass houses that had to be shifted, you know.
How big were the panes of glass?
They called them 14 by 16, that's inches.
Right.
14 inches by 16 inches.
Right.
And at those years, a lot of the glass came from Belgium, you know.
Yeah.
And most of the other stuff was just Oregon timber. The rafters were tin, virtually, you know.
The dimensions of
the glass house was on talking feet, about 112 feet long by about 14 foot wide.
Right.
You know? And, of course, in the beginning, there were only two panes of glass high, which were very low, and they were a nuisance to work in. Then if you got a bit more wealthy, you put an extra pane of glass, so you made them a bit higher, which were much more comfortable to work in. But you used to have to sow that the tomatoes in the virtually late summer, and towards June, July, you put in a crop of beans underneath and hope the crop did all right, you know, but they got by, you know. It was always a profitable type of business to be in. Of course, many years after, fumigation come in, and then they didn't have to change glasses every year. They could stay in the same place for 20, 30 years because the fumigation used to kill all the microbes in the soil and that, or any disease, and they'd be okay. That was a big help for market gardens. I think Johnny might have told you about glass houses in the same place for years and years and years. And that was it. But before that, no, you had to shift them every year, you know.
Uncle, Bruno, what was his name?
Attilio.
And he was your dad's brother?
Brother, yeah, younger brother.
Was he married?
Yes, he married. He went back to Italy and married, in about 48, 1948 he got married.
So the year that your father died was...
1949.
Right.
13th of March 1949.
And after that your uncle came...
Came down from Northern Territory and worked in the garden with my mother.
And lived in the house?
Oh, no, they had their own houses. We used to live next door to Albert Tonelato.
Right.
And it was a converted, renovated... They reckon it was a cow shed, whatever. But anyway,
this is your family home.
That's right. We were next door neighbours with the Tonelatos.
Yeah.
You know, always. I grew up with them till the age of about 14, And then we shifted to Frogmore Road, and my mother built this house in 1951.
And
date's still on the back of it. That's the one there.
We've got a photo of it
yes.
here. And there's a story about building this, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, the story, the foundation, there was no such thing as foundation rods. The steel in the foundations were the offcuts of the F.J. Holden, first F.J. Holden. So I remember they were about 6 foot long. They were about 3/4 inch, 7/8 inch, one end going down to about 10 mil. And strips of about, it might have been eighth of an inch thick or maybe a bit less. And we used to lay them one in front of the other, stacks of them. You used to just lay them around the place, and that way you're reinforcing for the concrete. The blocks, you could not buy bricks in those years. So we made our own solid cement blocks on weekends, and that was hard work too, because they would have been about, 16 inch by 8 inch by 4 inch. You know, still talking metric. I mean imperial. and they were pretty heavy. And
where did you get the material?
Oh, you used to... that's another thing. It's very hard to get cement in those years, you know. Through friends of friends that the father used to know people before he died and that, and they used to help out. There was a lot of helping out in those years, you know. It was built on weekends, you know. And those tiles, like a lot of other tiles in those years, came from India. There was no building material, not many building materials in Australia. They were the orange type coloured tiles. They're still very good, and they're still a very good tile. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Oregon timber all came from America in those years. All the roofing timbers come from America.
And how long do you think it took to build that house?
Oh, 2 years. And you could only build a certain area to the size of the family. You wasn't allowed to build any larger than family requirements. But because my mother had three sons, she could have 2 bedrooms. In those years, a lot of homes were built just the back section, like the laundry, the kitchen, and probably one room. And then they'd build the next section on after, when they had a bit more finance, of course, you know. But that's many places you used to see just the rear section of a place built, and eventually they'd build the front section. But that was real luxury in those years, to be able to live in a house finished like that in those years, because they were all still the asbestos. That was the main thing used in those years. Probably basically all asbestos homes or fibrous plaster inside, of course. But that was solid concrete, you know. Mm. And it was a very, very, very good home in those years.
And
you know?
Rare to find along Frogmore Road.
Well, that would be one of the... There was an older settlement, which is it's been knocked down so many years ago now, the corner of Valletta Road and Frogmore Road. But between from where that our home was, Frogmore Road to Valletta Road was just a series of potholes. In the wintertime, it was impassable because it was just full of water. And when I used to go to work at Tregoning with a push bike, you had to go in the gardens to get through. You could not get through the road because it was impassable. And many times, we used to pull out cars that got bogged in there with water and that. You have to pull them out with a tractor or a truck or something, you know, because tractors did come in later on. And the saying was that General Motors, they tested a few of their cars on that track to see if they water leaked inside. Oh, it was very bad. You couldn't go in the middle of the road in the wintertime. I've never seen a road like it. There wouldn't be a road around like that now, country.
When would it have been bituminised?
That would have been bituminised. That house was built in 1951, I suppose. That would have been bituminised 55 or after that. Did you see it too, Priscilla? Did you? Still rough. Oh, well, that would have been in the 60s. That would be going back in the 60s. It was just the section between Valletta Road and the end of... one checked where this house was. It had a stone base with a bit of bitumen on top. And I think because just down the side of this house, the Santons' home, they lived there at this time. But before that, it belonged to some people called Fewings. And they were landowners at the time, and they probably surfaced the road for their own use to go into their property. And that's where it stopped, you know, virtually. But it was all market gardens. I mean, the front section of this 5-acre lot where the house is built was pretty good growing soil, but the rear section was just sandy, you know, and you couldn't do much with it.
Was that going west towards...
Go west, yeah, right. towards the seaside,
right.
You know.
And when your mother and father were on that land, first of all, they were leasing it?
Oh, yes, they were leasing it from, they reckon it was belonged to the Scarths family.
The Harris Scarths.
The Harris Scarths family. They were ladies, apparently. You know, they, look, I stand to be corrected there, but there's other people. Albert would have known a bit more about that. He didn't.
No.
He didn't.
No.
They all said it belonged to the Scarths and that. But in those years, the occupiers of the land had first option to purchase. Of course, you know, we had 5 acres and that was it. Other people had 12 acres. But when they come to survey it with proper means, with better means than they had in those years, people finished up with 13, 14 acres for their 10 acres. People, we finished up with about 6 acres for 5 acres. You know what I mean? But it didn't make any difference anyway in those years. So you occupied that area and that's what you kept.
So if you say that there was 5 acres,
yes, that's what,
12 glass houses?
12 glass houses.
And anything else growing on that?
Not really, not much. Only a few beans, the outside beans at the time, and some, a few potatoes. But like I said, the rear section, about half of the land would have been just sand, and you couldn't do much with it in those years.
And was it level, or was it starting
no,
to be?
No, pretty level, pretty level.
Right.
But behind that property of ours, don't know who it belonged to, but we called it the sand hills, and that's where people used to go and get this red sand for doing whatever, and they might have been using in the building industry, because it was commercially dug out type of thing. Kidman Park through here, there's a lot of sand. If you go down, there's a lot of strips of red sand. But we weren't very too keen in going there because there's a lot of brown snakes around in those years. There was heaps of brown snakes. I remember with Albert Tonelato, I was on he was giving me a ride and a bike. We're coming home from an adjoining property, and this brown snake was in the middle of the road, and it stood up on its tail, you know, like you see in the books and that. But we really stood up, and it stood around about 1.5 metres high. And he got off the bike and he killed it. You know, of course, we were only.
How did he kill it?
Oh, he got an old fence post. He killed it with a fence post. Pretty game. The Albert would have been, I don't know, 22, 23 at the time.
And how old would you have been?
Oh, maybe I think I would have been about 8 or 9, something
so
like that.
So quite dramatic for you.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Of course, the story was that these snakes would never stop ringing until the sun went down, you know. So we used to go and check it out, but didn't reel too much.
Oh, no.
No, that was, oh, there's heaps of things to remember.
Well, there's another story, Bruno, that you told me about a young woman.
Yes, that was a tragic one. This would have happened, would have been in about the summer of 49, I'd say. And apparently this woman, I don't know, she must have, very nice, pretty top. She would have been in her probably mid to late 20s. They said she was a daughter of a hotelier. He had, you know, a chap that owned hotels and that. And she started off, they said, from Frogmore Road. And she just did a direct crossing. She just got a straight line, they say, you know.
Of course, in what direction?
At the time, I was 11, 12 at the time. She's going to, she's heading east towards
right.
the city from right. Frogmore Road. And she jumped through one glass house. She went right over one glass house, you know, crawled over one glass house. And somebody saw her and they said, what are you doing? She just kept walking, you know. She just kept walking, wouldn't say nothing. And then she come up to this boundary of the Tonelados where we were staying with them. And we were like kids playing outside. This was early, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon type of thing. Summer, the older people went to have a rest type of thing. And we were kids, we were playing around outside. I vividly remember this woman. She stood on top of this... it was a timber type fence. They used to be around those years. It was about 6x3 rail across the top with wooden posts, and they slotted in. And they were the type of fencing used around the place in those years. I vividly remember standing on top of that, and she just threw herself on a glass house. Of course, we got scared.
And how close would you have been?
The glass house wouldn't have been more than about 2 or 3 feet from the fence. You know,
and you were standing.
Oh no, we were a fair distance away. We might have been, say, about 300 yards away, 300-400 yards away.
But you were watching
no more.
Her.
Yeah. We just saw this lady. She was dressed in a white dress, and then she went over a couple and that. And next thing I heard, people screaming around the place. Called an ambulance out, and I remember the ambulance picking her up and taking her away. But she died. She bled to death virtually. She's cut everywhere. She just cut everywhere.
And what sense did you make of that?
Well, you know, we weren't allowed to go close, of course, because this is my uncle, Attilio, he was there at the time, and they just ripped up sheets, to bandage you up with that before the ambulance come there. But
it's
you don't forget it.
No, like such a dramatic thing. It's almost like hearing something from a movie.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I was only about 11 or 12, probably just turned 12 at the time, but vividly remember that, you know.
Yeah.
But you don't forget that.
No. And what other things would you have done as a child growing up?
We went to what was called Underdale School, which now is called Flinders Park. And I've never went to school during the war years virtually, but was never found any difficulty, you know, like being, these days they call it harassed or something, you know. No, never. Always been accepted at school and that. And not a great student, I suppose, but of course, homework was working around the class hours, you know, and that was it.
And what sort of social life would your family have had?
Oh, their social life was pretty limited, I think. You know, they used to get together on a Sunday afternoon, and I suppose they used to just, you know, play bowls if they could find a spot. I remember they used to go down to Rosewater. My father used to go down to Rosewater. But in those years, you only had so many gallons of fuel. You was restricted with your fuel because of the wartime and that, you know. And you had to be careful where you drove a truck, because if they saw you driving a truck without the purpose of going in the garden industry, I think they could have fined you or something, you know. Oh, yeah, that was right. And we used to take a chance and go to Rosewater. They had these butcher courts and that, and those kids we used to go there and just play with all the other kids of the parents at the time, you know. And that was a Sunday afternoon fun, you know. I mean, and then they used to go to St Kilda, which is just north of Adelaide, of course, but it felt like it was miles away at the time. That was a picnic time, once a year picnic time.
On the beach?
Oh, yes, on the St Kilda beach. And they used to have motorbike races and that, and different things and that. And they called it a swimming pool, but gee whiz, it was just a hole in the blue dirt, virtually. You know? And used to have their own way of having fun. As kids, we used to play cricket and football and that. Of course, you'd make your own bat. You couldn't ever buy one. And to have a tennis racket, that was a real luxury. You couldn't afford a tennis racket.
And there were quite a few families, weren't there?
Of course, yeah. There would be about seven or eight of us as young children from other parents that all around about the same age, some a bit younger, some a bit older, but you always used to get around. And, the parents used to get together on a Sunday, and, of course, my father being a heavy smoker and a few others, we all thought we'd try that smoking bit, you know, like kids used to do and that. And I think I was about eight at the time, and that's when I stopped smoking, because one of our friends, we thought he was a couple of years older, he grabbed some cigars from his parents, you know. Of course, he got us smoking cigars, and I think we threw up completely for a long time, and that was it. No more smoking after that.
That
was history. Probably a good idea. But they were good days, though. They were good days. Everyone got together, and you waited for the weekend. You'd all got together, and you'd have your fun. They'd have their probably bottles of beer and that in those years, and that was even restricted. You had to be careful, because some people started having these butcher courts and that, and they'd supply beer, but you had to have a licence and that. They used to get raided, and they all had their own little box to put their beer in and all that business. Oh, for God's sake, it was real. I don't know who ran the country in those years. Not completely different to now, that's for sure. But they were the good old days, I suppose.
And Bruno, you left school at
the age of 15.
At 15, and you went to
Gordon Tregoning's. I had to be there a year before. You had to sign up as an apprenticeship at the age of 16. So I was there a year from 15 to 16 before I could sign up as an apprenticeship, fitter and turner.
And there wasn't any possibility of you staying and working?
Oh, I didn't want to work in the garden.
Oh,
No. I had enough of shifting glass houses. And I remember going to work there at 15 or 16, I have to get up early, and we used to have to hand dig the glass houses, because of you had to dig them properly before you planted the tomatoes, of course, you know. And to hand dig them, that wasn't easy, and I did that a couple of times, and then I felt a bit sick at going to work after that, and I said, look, I'm not digging glass houses anymore, that's it, you know.
So how early would that have been?
Oh, you'd have to probably get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. did glass house for a couple of hours and started work at 7 o'clock, 7.30, sorry.
A long day.
It was a long day, yeah. Trigoning, it was good, but there we worked 9 hours a day. But then we used to have Fridays, finish at 11.30 Friday morning. Mm. And I think he still does that now. And he was a pretty tough master, but you learn the value of time, you know. I mean, that's you learn that if you talked about the job with someone there, even if you talked about what you was doing with a fellow worker and that, he'd come up and say, look, mate, time's worth fourpence a minute, you know, you had to keep doing your job. And you learn the value of time, and you learn to do pretty things pretty right too, you know. Because after that, I went to General Motors Holden and worked in the tool room there for a couple of years. And that was, I thought, if I had to learn more trade there, I'd have learned nothing compared to working for a private person type of thing, you know.
How big was Trigoning's at that time?
12 workers, 12 people, you know.
And you would have been the youngest?
Oh, at the stage I was. When I left, I think I might have been about the second or third longest serving person there. But then I bought my own machine and that, and I started doing work at home, and that's when I left there. I went to work at General Motors because he thought I might have been taking some business from him, you know. And he wanted to have a look at it. It wasn't a toy. It was about a fairly big machine, 10 horsepower motor, about 8 foot between centres, a pretty big lathe. And I started working at Holden's there for a couple of years, working afternoon shift from about 3.30, 4 o'clock. We used to start leaving home 3.30 until about 20 to 1. And then I'd come home and work on the lathe till about 5 o'clock in the morning.
What would you do?
Anything. I'd just machine up things. I had a friend that had a workshop, and he used to pass work on to me and that. And I don't know if you're not around the moment. They were 3-inch, they called 3-inch T-piece for the ENWS department in those years. They were like cast iron. They were like 75 mil T pieces in cast iron, and you used to have to bore them out both sides, or three ends of them, and hand thread them, put the thread inside them, but not with a die or nothing. You had to do it all by tool, by hand, not with the lathe, of course, but manually, not with a die or anything like that, and had a no-go gauge to make sure they were right, and did a heap of them, and did anything. I never said no to any work, and I just didn't know how to do it, but I did it in the end.
So you'd come home,
yes,
at, what, 1 a.m.?
Oh, about 1 o'clock in the morning, yeah.
And then work for another 4 hours?
Yeah, work, and after that I used to grow potatoes too.
So you were living with your mum?
Yep.
And what about your other brothers?
No, they were married. They'd gone out by then. Yeah. You know, they'd left the place. They'd married and they shifted out, and it was only me and my mother home, you know.
And what about the market garden?
No, that virtually, they bought 10 acres at a place called Bolivar, probably where Johnny used to be. And they shifted all the glass houses and things up there. So this land was vacant. It was vacant land, and I used to grow some potatoes on it. It was always going to be sold in those years, but there was a credit squeeze, I remember, would have been the early 60s and that, very early 60s. And you couldn't sell land, couldn't sell blocks of land. A bit different than now. But,
especially so close to the city.
You couldn't sell blocks of land in those years. Nobody wanted the land, you know. So that got stuck there for a while. And eventually it got sold, type of thing. But, there's a lot of history in the place. There's a lot of history.
And what happened then to your uncle? Like, what...
Well, after we grew up a bit older, my brothers took over the garden, and he got his own place. He bought his own property and started his own market garden business.
And where did he buy?
At Bolivar.
Oh, okay.
At Bolivar, out at Bolivar there. He worked out there for several years, and he went back to Italy in 65, and he wanted to go back to the home country. And, you know, strangely enough, he never ever did smoke, but he did die of lung cancer. Maybe through the mines dust or something, I don't know, but it's just one of those things. Never did smoke and die. How old was he, Shelley?
Yeah,
64, 65. 62,
63,
yeah. But much older than his age, he looked at the time. But it was all hard work.
Yeah.
You know, all physically hard work.
Very hard.
Yeah.
And what about your mum, like, in her life? Can you tell
Oh, well, I can only remember my mother working all the time. Although, when we were kids, I always remember you, on a Sunday, she used to take us to Elder Park, you know, get on the Popeye and that, and go to the zoo. Always remember
lovely.
That. We'd have been probably about 4 or 5, 6 those years, and then she had friends that lived in Hiney Street. And she'd call in there and have a cup of coffee, and then we'd come home with a tram, you know, virtually catch a tram on Henry Beach Road and walk back from there, you know, which was a bit of a distance. But
yeah.
Mum was very, very family orientated. You know, she looked after us very well, you know. Can't say nothing about that. Very, very good.
Did she return to Italy ever?
I took her back to Italy when I was 27, and Mum hadn't been back for 30 years, or just a bit over 30 years. She'd never been back to Italy, and I took her back. She went to see the place where she was a housekeeper at a young age. You know, this lady, she was still there, and she enjoyed it. You know, she really enjoyed it.
Your mother must have been young to be a housekeeper.
Oh yes, well that's what they used to do in those years. You know, they'd say go to servir, which means housekeeping. You know, they were housekeepers to the more affluent type people over there, and. A lot of them, I remember Johnny's mother, she went when she was 15 or 16. And she went a long way away from home, you know.
To Milano.
To Milano. At the age of 15, housekeeping. You know, that's
young
it.
Girl.
Oh, very young girl, you know.
And so for your mum to return was wonderful.
Yeah, very, very. It was very nice for her. She enjoyed it, I think. Yeah, very much. We were away for about.
Your mum had a lot of brothers.
Oh yes, yeah. My mother had her brothers over there still. You know, two brothers were still alive. Three brothers were still alive. One was, he was working. He's looking after a building in Venice. Another one was a policeman at Rome. We stayed with him in the Carabinieri. We stayed with him for about 3 weeks, and the other one was in the village. He was just she had still three surviving brothers. One of her brothers, at a young age of 21, 22, he was. In the Second World War, he got lost in Russia, you know, unheard of. Just went to war and no one heard whatever happened to him, you know. But they were tough years. They were tough years. But, they're very nice. The Pontano was a nice little village there close to Treviso, you know.
And your mum, you came back to live in Adelaide?
Yes, yes. Yes, we went with a ship called the Guglielmo Marconi. Which was only new at the time, it was about a year old, a pretty big ship for those years, 28,000 tonne. We come back with the same ship, and that's where I met my wife, on the boat, on the way back.
In 1965.
That was just coincidental, I suppose, because I went over there with the intention of driving around seeing Europe, you know, which is a big thing in those years, travelling around. In 1965, I went with a friend of mine, Vic Zarella, and I bought a car over there and we did 34,000 kilometres. We went from Spain to Sweden. We went everywhere. And we were in France when they were inaugurating the Mont Blanc tunnel. That was in 1965. I forget the date would have been, I suppose, roughly guessing, would have been about August, September, something like that. And we couldn't go through it at the time because it was for dignitaries only and workers and that. We had to wait another day, so I said, oh, well, we'll tick off, you know. Went into Berlin, went to Germany, went across through Checkpoint Charlie into East Berlin, which was very hazardous at the time. Went to the British Consulate at Frankfurt, and they told us, they gave us about 4 pages why we should not drive to Berlin, but we still did. It was an experience, you know. That was a great trip. Then we went up as far as Sweden, through Denmark, Sweden, and England. And then from London, my friend went back through America, and I drove the car from London back to Treviso. And I just slept one night. Didn't make any mistakes on the road. With the RAR, whatever they called it over there, they'd give us the itinerary, the line just read through the towns you went through, and that was no traffic, you know, not like now. I mean, I drove there about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and it was unbelievable.
The Autostrade.
Oh, the traffic is horrendous. You could drive with your eyes closed here compared to traffic over there. In those years, there were no vehicles on the road. Of course, the roads weren't that good, but they were all right.
How long did you go for?
The first time? Yeah. Well, the boat trip was about 22 days, about 8 months all up.
And did your mother stay in Treviso while you were
Yeah, traveling? she stayed in the towns there in Treviso while I was drove around for about 2 or 3 months with my friend, you know. And when I come back, she said, I've already booked the boat to come back to Australia. I got upset. I said, what did you book for, you know? Anyway, that's what happened. That's how I met my wife on the boat.
Well, What a nice story.
Yes.
So you met Graziella on the boat.
On the boat, after about 2 or 3 days on the boat, I think she got in. She got on at Messina, and just, I don't know, I've always had some funny feeling about girls smoking, and she used to smoke sometimes. I thought, gee whiz, I don't like that, you know. But anyway, I don't know what happened. I still asked her for a dance, and that was it. And at the end, I suppose, I only used to see her when we, at the night time, you'd always, there'd be some social activity on, dancing or something on the boat. And then I thought, oh, look, you know, I asked her for her address so I could write to her, you know. And at the last moment, she said, oh, look, here you are, here's my address, you know. So I thought, oh, well, fair enough. And after I was back in Adelaide for about a week, this friend of mine, Gus Torres, a good friend, he said, you've written to Graziella yet? I said, no. He said, what are you waiting for, you silly bugger, you know? I said, oh, well, I don't know how to write Italian, you know. So I went and got a dictionary. I still got an Italian-English dictionary, and it took me about a week to write a letter. Don't know what it sounded like, but...
Because you'd spoken with your mum in dialect.
Oh, complete, only dialect.
Yeah.
Actually, I was that good in dialect that when I went to Venice in those years, I was speaking to the gondoliers, you know, and they could not believe that I was born in Australia. You know? He said, you speak perfect dialect. I said, well, I learned now virtually, you know. But being there quite a few months, you learn that pretty quick and that. And even now, that's all I really speak. I can't really speak the Italian. It'd sound funny if I try to speak Italian, but... the dialects are very simple and they all understand you. Well, basically they do. And in Venice, that's all they speak.
Yes.
In Venice, they only speak the Venetian dialect, you know. So.
And Bruno, was it unusual in your day to be a young man at 27, not married?
No, well, everyone used to get married at 23, 24 in those years. That's a fact. Everyone used to get married younger, you know. But I had this always strange feeling that... I wanted to go overseas, you know, and that was it, you know. But, of course, it was very hard to get the money to go overseas. I think the boat trip cost me about £196 one way and £108 the other way, you know. It was still a fair bit of money. And I think the money I spent overseas, I probably could have bought a half a house in those years, you know, but who cares?
So
still kept saying it's the best money I spent.
Did you resign from General Motors
to go? Yes, I resigned from General Motors when I in 65. And then when I came back, my friend said, oh, look, when are you going to start working at Holden's again? I said, what for? You know, I sort of become independent. And before I left, I always thought, well, where's my next bit of money coming from? You know, you had to rely on that weekly wage and that. And being away for 8 months and not having a wage every week type of thing, you become a little bit more daring. I thought, well, what do I want to go to work for a boss for? I'm going to start working at home. What are you going to do? I said, I don't know, but I'll do something, you know. And they had an old garden shed. And in those years, in 66, their law had come out that every home site, they had to have their own privy, like a toilet, in those before that. So this law came out, and I thought, oh, well, I'll start making them things, you know, and start making these little toilet things, you know. And then builders would come around and say, what else do you do? I said, oh, I'll do anything, you know.
What kind of toilets do you mean?
You might see them on sites even now, but they're plumbed up to plumbing and that now.
Oh, like a little...
Yeah, little
house.
Privy, they call them, little privies. They're a toilet, little portable toilets they were, virtually. That's
made
all they
were. Of?
Iron, just iron, you know, with an iron door. Just corrugated iron, that's it. One sheet wide, about 1.5 sheet of iron deep type of thing, that's it. And about 6.5 feet high, and that was it. Bit of ventilation around the top, and that's all they were.
That's a proper toilet.
Yeah, $49 used to sell them for.
So who did you sell them to?
The builders. Every builder had to have one on site. Before that, people used to go to next door neighbours if they had to go to toilets and that, you know.
Oh.
So that wasn't on. So every building site, every house building site had to have one of these toilets. And other firms started making them and hiring them out, but builders used to virtually have their own because they never cost much, you know. And they'd have it. These builders would keep building. They'd have them all the time. And... that's what I started doing. And then builders say, what do you do? I said, look, anything. You know, started doing lintel bars for arch bars for windows and doors and that, any steel work, staircases, you know, balustrades, gates.
And this is all from your shed?
All old garden shed. And in between time, I started making, there was a bit of a demand for a reversible plough. That was a Ferguson reversible plough. And And you couldn't buy them anymore because they stopped making them in England in those years and that. So I thought, oh, well, I'll try making these things. You know, people said, oh, you can't do that. You know, and I virtually did. I made quite about 60 of them, these reversible ploughs. And in those years, a friend of mine said, oh, look, there's this government wants to export products made from South Australia. You could export to these Iran, Iraq, and these places. You know, there was a demand for these type of things there. Small implements, like only three-point linkage implements. And I thought, well, it's a bit hard, you know. I don't really want to employ people. I'd sooner work by myself, you know. And then this chap said, oh, no, we'll get these other people to handle for you, Hord Bagshaws. They were down at Mile End, you know. And they come to my workshop one day, about six or seven of them, the hierarchies, because I asked them if they wanted to export these implements for me. And for whatever reason, they just shook their head and they couldn't believe I could make that type of thing in that. In the place I was, you know, that old garden shed I was, I'm making this implement, which was virtually better quality than what they were making at Mile End, you know.
And how long would it take you to make one?
About a week.
Wow.
About a week. But I used to make them about half a dozen at a time, like all the parts and the machine parts I had to do. I had to get the foundry parts made from Mason and Cox, and they'd be steel castings, not malleable steel, which are better quality. Certain things you couldn't get the same quality of shafting and that you required from the original ones because they weren't here, you know. But they come out all right, and I did very well with them.
What did Horwood Bagshaw
say? Oh, well, I didn't go on with the project and that, but the name got around. They reckon, oh, you're spoken about in Melbourne, this and that and the other, and I didn't really, you know, too busy to worry about things like that. And so I just sold them locally. I sold them a few up at Port Hedland and Geraldton in Western Australia. And around the place, and Campbelltown, there was a lot of market gardens still around the place. And then I made disc cultivators, I designed my own disc cultivator in those years, and sold quite a lot of them, you know, that kept me busy. And with the building and...
Scoops, anything.
Do anything, you know.
So what...
I virtually wanted to work from a set spot, not go out and do maintenance work here, there and everywhere type of thing, you know.
So what years are we talking about?
This would be late 60s, because early 70s I thought, well, this is, if I started employing people, you had to make $300 for them, then you had to make $300 for yourself. So, but I used to work a bit too quick for them. I had a few people come there and tried a few people, and that too slow. They'd hold me up and I'd had to redo their work sometimes and that, and I said, no, this is not on. So I'd do twice as much by myself as I would with someone else, you know. But then in the early 70s, and there was only about two other people doing it, I built a big warehouse. With the understanding was that I'd go into it myself. The Woodville Council, I was working in a residential area. And there wasn't, people couldn't really complain because it was 5 acres around the workshop type of thing, you know. But of course, if I'd work late at night, it'd make their TVs go funny with the welding. They didn't like that too much. So I built this big warehouse, about 1,200 square metres and that. And then I thought, well, look, I might as well lease it. So because that's money coming in without working, you know. So I leased it to, first was Chrysler. That's back when Chrysler were around. They had their air conditioning department went in half. And then Shell Australia, they took a half of it, you know. Then they eventually took a lot of it, you know, and they had to deal with them, and they were very good tenants for about 14 years and 15 years. And after that, I thought, well, this sounds all right. So I kept building a few of these warehouses, physically building them, did the lot myself, I think being a steel worker. And I had my own little crane. I bought this little crane that I still got it. It only lifted about a tonne now, but it's lifted more than that. And that was a bomb hoisting crane from Portsmouth Aviation in England. It was brought out to Australia by Wilkins and Burnside, I think, or one of those people. They bought half a dozen of these small, they were virtually wartime cranes. Mm-hmm. It's a fully sluiced, 360 degree, it'll do a 360 degree circle and that, magic little thing. And it was described as a bomb hoist, the tag's still on there, it's called Bomb Hoisting Crane 1953. Portsmouth Aviation, you know, still got the tag there. And then I used to do work with that around the place, and a friend of mine, well, he was a chap that I used to do work for at the time, he was the mayor of Woodville, John Dyer. Did a fair bit of steel work for him, he's a good builder in those years. And he said, I've got something to take down at Port Adelaide there. It was a bow repair, the tyres were in the place at the moment. can you come there with a crane and take this big beam down, you know? So I said, all right. I never said no. I said, so I went there, took this beam down with a crane. It was very heavy, you know, it was a bit too much for the machine, but anyway, I got it down. The next day, I get a knock on the door, the Department of Labour Industry come to see me. And they said, what do you do with this machine? I said, oh, just a yard crane for myself. No. He said, this machine was seen at Port Adelaide yesterday. I said, oh, blimey, now I'm in trouble, you know. And they give me the rundown. Don't you ever let this machine go out of this property. I said, okay, mate, no worries, I wouldn't. And I used it when I built property here at Beverley, and Lysart supplied the iron in those years. And I said, look, no more than quarter ton packs because my machine won't lift it. Of course, they supplied half ton packs, you know. And these sheets were about 40 foot long, 12 metres type of thing. And I had to unload them with this crane, you know. I think I'd be, I don't know where I'd be now if they caught me, but anyway, the power lines were about 3 foot from the top of the jib, and the back wheels were about 2 foot off the ground, and I'd swing around with these things, and I'll tell you what, I wouldn't do it now anymore.
No, dramatic.
Dramatic, very dramatic.
But Bruno, if we go back to 1965 when you met Graziella, yes. When did you marry?
66.
Six months and three days later.
I'd known her on the boat. I met you when? About 2 days out of Messina. Mm. And I only danced with her a couple of times.
Each other 30 times,
not
days.
How many?
Wow.
30 times.
And when you married, where did you live?
With my mother, in this house. In this house, the original
in the house.
Yeah, we lived there till... Until we came
13
here.
Years
13 now. Years.
So you lived there 13 years, and yes. That's where you had your workshop in
that's
the
right,
garage?
Adjoining this. Yeah, the workshop is there. That's the old workshop there.
Oh, right. Yeah. I see it on
an
the
old
right
garden
side.
Shed.
I'm interested to...
I've got other photographs of that.
That would be great.
Yeah, I've
to
got
see
other
them.
Photographs of where I was working there too. With the, where will they be, Graziella? We'll have to look for it for next time.
Yeah.
I've got things I used to make and that. Photographs of the implements I made and stuff like that.
Machines for the workshop as well.
Great. Yeah. That's terrific. Mm. So you and Graziella had four children?
Four children, yes.
And you're a grandfather of...
Four.
Of four,
yeah.
Now.
Sarah and Ruby, and Zaki and Zaza. Yeah, she's wonderful. Oh. They're all wonderful. Yeah. But they're cheeky. When they go to school, they become cheeky.
And I'm interested to know, you know, why do you think you had this streak of independence? You know, you told me that you didn't
well,
you know,
if
want
I,
to
if
work.
If I never left Australia, I'd still be working wages. And when we were in overseas and we met, we always used to, probably had a bit of a phobia because, not a phobia, but... you felt a little bit like you're his Italian background, you go to Australian dances and that. Never bothered me, but there's always a little bit of sus there, you know.
From and other people?
Yes, from other people, especially from parents of Australian girls, of course, you know. Oh, they used to always have a bit of a, I don't know, anyway. But because they all grouped Italian as, you know, I mean, in those years, I remember young lads, migrants, coming from Italy and that. Of course, they were living by themselves. They used to wear these dark shirts and that, and probably never had too many means of washing and that. They wouldn't let him in dances. I'd never ever been refused because we were virtually like Australians, you know. I mean, never been refused, never been discriminated against whatsoever all my life, you know. And the independent came with that when we were over there and we met these, you know, this car we had was 1,500 Fiat, and of course at the back we had written Australia over it. In those years you could do these things, you know. Of course they'd stop you and have a chat and that and, oh... And then, of course, I bought this car in Rome through my uncle that was in the Carabinieri, through his friend that was the mechanic for the Carabinieri. He bought this particular car. He said, this is a good car, you won't have trouble. I said, very good, you know. He was right, it was a good car. And they'd stop us, these girls would stop us when we were driving through France, wherever we were. And, they saw Australia and Rome and that, and saw, oh, gee, Rome's a beautiful place, you know. And I said used to say to these girls, first thing I'd say, look, what do you think of Italians now? Oh, terrific, they're terrific. I always thought that this country would have been a far, I don't know how you would describe it, but it would be a fantastic country if it was possible in the education system after year about, I'm talking back 60s, not now, but back in the 60s and that, if they could have like exchange students for 6 months of a year year one type of thing, like year eight now they call it. This would have been a far different way of thinking country, because it's very narrow thinking in those years, you know. But if they went overseas and saw the difference, oh, when you come back, this is magic compared to what was over there. That was nice, but you wouldn't swap it, not even now, for any money, you know, with any other country you go to. I mean, we went to America 3 years ago. I wouldn't swap this for that anywhere. No way in the world. You know, this is by far the best country you could... The best secret, best kept secret, all right. You know, but I thought it would be a wonderful thing if in the education system they could do that, exchange students for 6 months and get them to go overseas and see how it was, and then see how lucky they are when they came back here. Mm. You know, that's what the difference would have been, you know.
You've obviously had a very strong sense of being an independent person.
Yep.
In terms of work and...
Yes, because I suppose because I lost my father at a young age, and I was always by my brother a bit discriminated against because they were older than me, of course, and I used to have to be told what to do. I said, well, look, one day I'm going to do what I want to do, you know, and not be told what to do. And that's what probably drove me a bit more to be able to just be independent, you know, and never look back. You know, virtually, I wouldn't even consider going back to work. When I came back from Italy, I didn't have any money in my pocket.
And was your mother concerned that you weren't going to be earning wages?
Well, not really, but, you know, I still had a few dollars left when I come back. But when we got married, remember, I happened to borrow about $6,000 to get married with, and that we could. She thought I was rich, but that was far from it.
And who did you borrow from?
The bank, you know, virtually borrowed the bank, gave me some money. On the land, borrowed some money.
In his name by then.
Did okay since, you know, did okay since. But a lot, only through very hard work, and like I say, it was. Well, Saturday and virtually Sundays too. I didn't look at the rest days and that, but...
16 hours a day.
Oh, yeah, we used to work on...
So you've had a very strong driving force.
Yes, I'd say you'd have to say that, yeah, very strong. More so than a lot of the friends of mine. They were happy to just, you know, plod along and that, and they say, oh, gee, you were lucky. I said, yes, I know, but the harder you work, the luckier you get, you know that, you know, which was very true in my case.
And Bruno, when did your mother die?
She died, we were going to go overseas in 1985. We were booked to go overseas. Well, I wanted to take the children on the Canberra. It was coming into Adelaide. This was in March. And we booked a trip with the Canberra.
Yeah, and mum died in March.
But the trip was going to leave in March. The boat was going to leave in March. But my mum got sick and that. Of course, I had to cancel it. Couldn't go in the Canberra, you know. And then
she died 28th March.
Yeah.
2085.
Yeah, 28th of March 1985. She was 77 years old.
Right.
So then we had to cancel that trip, so we had to rebook later on. After a couple of months, I rebooked again this trip, you know. So rebooking this trip, I'm ready to go again with Johnny Marchiotto's father, because he was going at the time.
Yeah.
And then I one of the rare times I got sick, touch wood, and we're pouring these footings I did for warehouse I built at Beverley. And I come home and my eldest daughter Vivian had to go to Perth. Well, she was going to go to Perth there to see her cousins and that. And that night I was that sick and that, and I couldn't twist and turn in bed. I couldn't sleep and that. And I took at the airport in slippers. I was that crook, you know. On the way back, I didn't even stop. I stopped. There was a doctor's surgery here on where the reserve is virtually. There's a house this side of the reserve on Frogmore Road. I said, look, I think I'm a bit crook. So on the letter A, so I stopped there and he said, well, you better book in for the hospital or something. You know, you go and have a checkup. I had kidney stones.
Oh.
And they were so painful, I'd hate to describe. I don't go through that feeling again. So that was another cancellation of a trip. So we had to postpone again this trip to Italy in 85. And so this other cousin of mine that's here, he said, well, you're not going to go again, are you? I said, what do you mean? He said, third time. He said, you're gonna really go again? Listen, mate, I'm not superstitious. That's it. We did,
you know. And you did.
Yeah,
oh,
and
that
was all okay.
Great.
So we took the four children with us overseas. And they were all... I was a bit worried because the eldest one was 16. Vivian was 16. The youngest one was...
Vivian 16,
and Belinda and Laura.
And it was a good trip.
Yes, a very good trip. Yeah, no one was sick.
Well, that was great.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much for the interview.
That's okay.
That's really good. Thank you, Bruno.
Okay.